in other facets of society. This is really leaning on what Riaboa did with the campaign, and just bringing it a bit closer to just make sure that these faces and names and stories are not forgotten. And then to carry that thread, we are also doing features on young people who are doing incredible things right now, and hoping that their work also kind of pushes into the future. So this is again leaning on different focus areas, whether it's economics, feminism, sexuality, gender and sexuality work. And in both aspects, we are taking lessons or learnings from our sexual practices, gender identification, and also some practices that either exist now or have evolved and become better in the present.
Okay.
Ray, so it's in this backdrop that we're doing this interview. And so the first thing I wanted to ask is, a lot of the, when I've had interactions with you, some of the interviews I've seen, and also some of the writings I've seen about you, you speak a lot about your dad.
Yeah.
And the question there for me is, in the greater scheme of how we understand feminism and even African feminism, how much influence do you think that that relationship had on you, even without calling it feminism, on you being able to own who you are?
So the first thing I want to say is, growing up in a home that is not normal in the patriarchal sense was a huge blessing.
Right.
So when I grew up, the person I was really afraid of was my mom. She was loud, probably as loud as I am, and she had a very sharp tongue. And the person I identified as my nurturer was my dad.
Right.
And so what became very stark when I grew up was the fact that the way that the church or the school or society was telling you of how families are structured is not the only way, because my reality was completely different. You know, I was just like, no, man, you know, this whole thing that, you know, the man is the head, and then, you know, you don't cross the man's, you know, word, the man's word is final. You know, you don't have to have an opinion, and women are naturals, and men are something else. Was just not a lived experience for me.
Right.
And for a very long time, I did not know what that meant, because I really did not have the words, the language of feminism, patriarchy, and whatever. I just knew that it was weird, you know. And some of the things, for an example, I found weird was a father or a man eats a certain piece of meat. Or when there is meat, the first person that gets dished for was the father. And I'm like, wait. Because it was never really my experience.
Yeah.
The second thing is, I then have memories of some of the things that my father did for me that were nurturing. And I want to hold the fact that this is somebody, like, I don't want to say that this is the relationship that all of my siblings, and we are all girls, have with my father or appreciated about my father. I just felt that in my father, the right circumstances happened for me to become the person that I am. And one of the things was that my mother was a nurse. So as you know, nurses would work night shift. And so night shift, even. For me, I remember more night shift. And I remember evenings where my father would be fetch me from my grandmother's house, which was in the same street. And, he would get home and he would cook and he would dish. And then as he ate, I must have been 7 or 8. As he ate, he would be reading the newspaper and he would put me on his lap. And he would read, and he would even test whether I can read, because I had started school, and whether I could recognize like some English words. So the idea that I need to excel in school and I needed to have, you to know world news came from, and it's still inspired by, I need to impress daddy. because if it's I don't know what's the right English word about it, if it's implanted on you that that activity is really what will impress dad, and dad will just be so proud of you. It just became, so and also just an understanding of that. And so this that thing in particular, I think until my father died, also helped my dad and I have a relationship that was very uniquely ours. About having news that I know I want to share with my dad. And I now work, and I'm a single parent, and I work in issues around issues facing women. And when 60% of children are growing up in child-headed households, it hits so hard in my gut, including my own children, because I know what it meant for me and how it shaped me, that at seven, there is this man who looms large in your life because you are 7 years, who's present. And his presence is also not financial presence. It's, in fact, my father was very stingy, and there are some financial things and some financial decisions. Like one day I wanted Barca shoes, and they bought me, the fake Hong Kong Barker shoes. You know, so I don't, the things that mattered to me was not what patriarchy says the value of a father is, that he's the provider. I've never really, but it's his presence. Here you are on a lap, and then he's reading, and he says, read that sentence. And then, you are putting, a few sentences, and like, you can do it. And you're like, yo, I'm such a smart girl, You walk away with such a sense of, yo, man. And I still walk away like that. Like, I, while patriarchy has beat me up in different ways and wrestled with me in the mud, but what my father, and that moment with my father helped me realize, is that I'm special. Nah, I'm special. Nah, I can read English, and my father loves it when I read English. And I'm interested in world issues. And who says I must be interested in world issues? My dad. And that's important.
I wanted to actually then just branch it out a little bit and say, in your, in being, for lack of a better framing, the apple of your father's eye, in being, because, or maybe your father being that apple to you, because he was this just gigantic person who was ever present, in your relationship, on your relating either with masculinity or with men, did that shape that relationship, or the relating with?
I laugh because it shaped it in a very, very in a negative way. And I want to qualify the negative. So I've never really believed that I need a man who's a provider. That wasn't the framing of who my father was in my life. Like, it really wasn't. I don't have the concept of the man being the provider. It doesn't mean that my father didn't struggle at some times in his life when he could not provide. It doesn't mean that my father was not patriarchal. But what mattered most in our relationship, because he was present in my life in different ways. I've never looked for a man who's a provider. Like, I just, like, all I know is my father saying, you must work hard. You must earn your own money. You are, you can do everything that you want to achieve. The world is your oyster. There was never a dialogue from this man that was such a large figure in my life that, oh, my child, I want you to be married to a doctor. In fact, there was no dialogue that I want you to be married, let alone married to who. It was just like... And at some point, I remember when I started having problems in my relationships, my father was just like, why do you even bother? You know, like, why? Why bother with boys?
Next question is that, do you think your father, like, you're saying, Mana, there was no notion of there being someone who needs to be providing for you. Instead, it was like, do your best and make sure that you provide for yourself. So do you think in these exchanges, there was almost like that infusion where if it was a group of boys who kind of egg each other on when climbing a tree, or the other one telling each other, "Ma bra, ngikuhlule ngomunye," do you think that it was that kind of relationship where it's almost like that people will call it a masculine energy, but I think we all kind of have that push, bana, you must just do it because who else is supposed to do it? Do you think it was the thing, almost like the audacity of doing whatever you want, that manly energy, bana, I can do whatever I want, I can go wherever I want, I can be whoever I want. Do you think that was the kind of exchange you guys had?
You know, it's an interesting thing, and it's going to go back. I think, and I do come into the world with some masculine energy, like, yeah, I'm brave, I don't care. Mm-hmm. That I got from my mother.
Ah, I wanted to go back.
And I think because my mother and I had a complex relationship, I did not acknowledge it until I was much older, that in fact, the kind of masculine, you know, daredevil kind of side of me, I actually got from my mother. So, so the beauty of being born in a family that does not go according to the patriarchal norm was my gift, both from my mother and my father. Okay, my father was, for me, he was a silent, nurturing voice.
Right.
You know, he came across very gently, but also very, very caring. And that meant that all that my father, you know, did for me was to say, it is all okay and you are all okay and there is nothing missing in you. And I'll give you an example, because this conversation, this is not the first time it's coming to mind, but it often comes to mind. You know, with the stigma around HIV. So my father and I continued this very special relationship that was born out of the fact that I was the first born and the second person. I'm 8 years older than them. And so we spent a lot of time together with my dad while my mother was working as a nurse. So we continued it even in my adult years. So my father would know stories about my friends, because if my friends are going through things, I'll tell my father. My father would meet my friends. I'll take my friends home. And as the firstborn, I'll be the one that is taking most of my friends home, you know, and all of that, as the firstborn, because you break a number of barriers and test the family around what is acceptable, what is not.
Right.
And I remember one person that I knew very closely being diagnosed with HIV, when HIV was a stigma. And I think it weighed heavily in my heart. And I said to my father, you know, hey, man, my father asked me that day, where's so-and-so? And I basically say, oh, so-and-so is there, but I'm so worried about them. They tested positive. And my father, without missing the beat, says, oh, but I don't think it's their fault. And I also heard that there will be treatment coming. And I think it's expensive, but they are working so they can get treatment. And I, like, without missing a beat. And that for me is one conversation with my father. And he was by no means a perfect man. And he was as patriarchal as, you know, patriarchy shapes men, etc. But here was in this man somebody who, for me, knew all the right things to say when they mattered.
Right.
He has a father who demonstrated what they thought about women who will have sex and then contract HIV.
Right.
He has a man who could have said, yeah, what were they doing? Yeah, it serves them right. Yeah, blah, you know, you young people or whatever, because, you know. And he has a man who says, oh, it can be, something can be done. You know, and when you hear people saying they have been disowned and I wouldn't dare tell this to my father. And I still had that. I mean, I still was brought up black around what is acceptable, what is not. So children nowadays and youth and young adults shock me when they even my own children when they can just talk about everything and sundry. You know, I wouldn't go to my father and I said I had sex today, for an example, or whatever.
Mm.
But he knew what to say at the right time,
right,
in the most nurturing point. So the one thing I knew from him was that unconditional love exists. If you I'm linking it to your first question about, you know, how did it shape your relationship? But the thing is that I did not expect a man who was a provider. Like, and I don't even think that my father would look at any guy from the point of view and say, oh, no, keep that one, you know, will look after you.
Provide.
It was never a criteria. And unfortunately for me, Shem, my dating history is hopeless where that is concerned. I never secure the bag. I just never secure the bag, you know.
Because you look like you can, it's a problem.
You know, I just never secure the bag. And I also think that because my dad is so nurturing, part of me in a relationship looks for that nurturing part in men. You know, I'm forever looking for, you know, an aspect of my father that made our relationship work, you know. And in a lot of ways, it's not always a positive thing. And by that I mean, I think because he was my father, I was probably blind to his weak points. That would probably frustrate my mother as a lover. You know, I wasn't the lover, I just wanted a father who thinks the world of me, you know, because you also then see that when you get those gentle people, sometimes they are just too gentle, you know, and as lovers, they can be frustrating. But on the main, what my dad did for me is that although I have not secured the bag, I have been the bag. You know,
you've never
and had when you, yeah. So when you understand feminism and why women owning their own money, you know, and owning their own resources, how that is so important, and being paid for the labor that they do, even when they are caretakers, even when they stay at home and they are not in what we call the formal economy. When you understand that, you realize that, oh my goodness, I'm so glad that I was never brought up. There are a lot of things that I must unlearn. And having a man as a provider is not one of them. You know, because I've never looked at relationships or men in that way at all. I've always understood that if I want a fancy car, I must get a fancy car. If I want this, I must get it. And it has given me a lot more. Now that one understands feminism, etc., it has given me a lot more than just the means to do it myself. It has given me agency. It has given me a whole lot more, because just controlling your own finances is great.
Definitely able to say, so then there is your dad being this nurturing, very present person. And then you've also got a mom who, as you're stating now, fundamentally is working and getting paid for her work. Unfortunately, still think that nurses are not getting paid their worth, but
yeah,
getting literally going out to secure the bag consistently. Do you think that was for you? Well, in retrospect, that was feminism in practice. Do you think it's something that she felt she had to do because of whatever the circumstances were?
My mother was interesting because my mother was very patriarchal. So what my mother taught me is that patriarchy is a system.
Mm-hmm.
Because, in fact, I think it messed with my mother's mind that my father was not acting the patriarchal provider.
Ah.
And, in fact, when they would fight, also fight about how my father chose to parent me, because, you know, my mother wanted a very strict parent and stuff like that. It would be, you know, yeah, I'll report that Lebogang has done this, because I tested my mother to no end. I've reported that she has done this, and you know, what kind of a father are you? You know, or what kind of a man are you? And maybe deeper into their relationship, there was value in saying, and you could see she's grappling with the patriarchy, but in her mind, there was a particular way in which a father needs to be scary and take that role, you know, of saying, there's a man in this house, I'm going to take the role. And my father was just happy-go-lucky. Yeah, there's no role that I'm going to take. Yeah. The vacancy, the position is vacant. You know what I mean? Which I loved. For me, I was just like, hey, look at my rock star. You know, he's just taking things easy. You know? Because for me, I needed that nature. I couldn't relate to this man that is going to be, you know, like the Rottweiler in the house and stuff like that, right. You know, kind of thing. But interestingly, while I fought a lot with my mother, I had deep, deep respect for my father, which turned into to revere him to a point where you fear them. And I think there is an African word for fear that is not fear. So if you woke me up one day and you said, who would you die if you were to disappoint them? It would be my father. It wouldn't be my mother.
Mm.
So that very hard, you know, hey, you're not going to do that ish with me.
Mm.
I would want to defy. It took out the defiance in me to say, okay, let me do it and see what's going to happen. But this, I love you and I want the best for you.
Mm.
Even when I fell pregnant when I was at university at 20, the thing that came to my mind is, how could I do that to my father?
Mm.
How could I do that? You know, this man has wanted me to succeed. This man has wanted me, you know, to take my education seriously, to be the best that I could do. How could I?
Yeah.
And I knew that the person who was going to come down at me with a ton of bricks was my mother, and I didn't care. It just didn't matter. It's like, whatever. Whatever, you will shout and scream, but whatever.
Mm.
I'm pregnant. So it, you know, almost it goes counterintuitive now that I'm the parent to say this is what happened, you know, for me, that not acting patriarchal. And that's why maybe I reference him a lot. It's because mm-hmm. I then, in his presence, developed a very good relationship with him mm-hmm. because we were quite close. But I think I'm also taking what those lessons are in terms of what then it meant for me in the way that I carried myself, different to my mom. But I've grown older to realize that, in fact, who I am in terms of just, I mean, I'm loud, I'm daring, I think in most ways, and that's from my mom. So they were the perfect combination for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's quite interesting the dynamic you're speaking about, Lebo, because there's a notion around the notion of being groomed by patriarchy, right? Where you find yourself. I'll make a perfect example with me. I think my dad and I had an alliance of sort, similar to you and your dad, an alliance of sort. I was the firstborn girl. And I found that he was a little bit softer on me than my mother was. Very, I think to a very large extent, she was afraid. She still is, for us as girls, because there's three of us girls. But I, to an extent where, I was having a conversation with someone and they were saying, there's a thing around being groomed by patriarchy to a point where, it takes us a really long time to look at our mothers and realize that they had to be the hard ones for our fathers to be the soft landing spot. So I'm just trying to see in retrospect, to what extent do you think that that's the case for you, where the softness, the, as you say, your father was self patriarchal, but you still had that nurturing, and as the, and the, on the, not even on the flip side, in the same kind of vein, you had your mother who was very like, and and all of these things. So she had to be the strict one. So in what do you think that there is truth to the notion of patriarchy does not necessarily evolve or change, and people don't necessarily move away from roles. It's just that the women have to be the devil so that the men can be the soft landing spot.
I mean, I think... I think yes. You know, so I think there's two things. And in fact, somebody else opened my eyes to what you were saying before, which I hadn't seen. And that was, I think, a feminist teaching about 2.5 or 3 years ago. I think on one level, there are families, like my family, for an example, where the very stereotypical, blatant patriarchy at the surface of it gets defied. So you are in a home where your father does not behave like what culturally and whatever fathers are meant to do. I mean, my mother, I remember some of the things that he would say, and she would basically say when she's irritated, if there was a man in this house, I wouldn't have to hire somebody to cut the tree or do whatever, you know, because in her mind, the world is organized that way. And the reminder was always, you are not the man that, you know, society tells me a man should be like. And yet she was the most spoiled woman by this man who, no matter what argument that they had, will make her a cup of tea, will be there, you know, and do porridge in the morning and stuff, where you look and you say, hey, this one, I wish she could meet the boys that I'm meeting. Boys don't do what my father is doing. This is TLC that you are basically getting. You know, so the tree's not cut. The manly things are not done, but this guy does things that I know. I've heard other men and boys saying that is not a manly thing to do. Right. And yet for me, I marvel in it because I want all of these things. So I think on one level, that was the defiance. But as a system, patriarchy, and I think because if you think about it, I'm 50, so my parents would have been in their mid to late 70s right now, is that I've got the benefit of only very recently feminism and patriarchy even becoming concepts that some of us, not even all of us, are talking about. For them, they still had to go back to a world that made sense for them. So the second part of saying the black mothers that had to be crazy and shout and swear and give you that back slap, you know, that whatever, had to do that because they are grooming you for a world that is not kind.
Right.
So it's a world that has brutalized them, but it's also a world that says, you, with your loud mouth, you are going to get into trouble. So I'm going to slap you for society. I'm fixing you for society so that you know that you are not going to go around opening your mouth.
That women like you.
Women like you, you know, and why are you not, and also you are frustrating them. Because when they are sitting with other women, and you know how patriarchy is, we also boast, hey, my child is married to a doctor. Hey, when now you are busy having children out of wedlock, you know, you are busy doing your own thing. And how is she understanding it? She's going to say, yes, it's that man that did not instill the rules. Now I'm going to be the rule instiller. So my mother would be to say, I'll look after the child, but every Friday after school, you are going to be here at home. Because it's like, women don't do that. Women don't go around enjoying their sex and then having children.
Exactly.
Like, I'm going to, So they do. They do. Remember, all of them are acting within this, you know, this harsh set of world order and world systems, you know. And then what then happens is that you also, as a child in there, you oscillate between, I'm feeling shameful, I'm feeling ashamed, I've brought shame into my family, but also I know I'm better than this, you know. So for an example, at my graduation, when my father spoke for the first time about how disappointed he was when I fell pregnant at second year, it pierced my heart. Because when I came home pregnant, my father did not express that. I wasn't chased away from home. My father was very excited when my daughter was born. But when I graduated, and at the graduation speech, where my daughter was 2, and it's like, you know, I was so disappointed when I was like, oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God.
The one thing you feared.
The one thing I feared, you know, had happened. And that was the first time I had, my mother, I knew how she feels. Yeah, you got to think just because you're sleeping with boys. You are not a woman. It's like, okay, you've made your feelings known. Okay, girl, you've made your feelings known. You know, But to hear that from my father was so, yes, the mothers then, and especially because particularly where parenting is concerned, we hold women responsible for enforcing patriarchal norms. And we put value and worth in their ability to do so. So when a girl child comes home pregnant, the person who will think that the society is judging them harshly is the woman for not being a good parent, not the man. First and foremost, we are not even expecting the father to be there in the first place.
Yeah.
That's how freedom they've got. We are not expecting them to even be there. Okay? So it's then understandable how the father could really be, like how the mother, sorry, could then feel that this was almost an affront on them.
So, Lebo, are you saying, Ubana, I'm just referencing the campaign as well slightly. Are you saying that outside of, oh, Mamuni did this, Mangmang did that, we're also, there's a sense of raising women in general. Oh, I'll say this, like, in terms of voice, like, who was your mother as a lover, you know? Who was your mother as a friend, you know? Who did your mother hope to be when she birthed you? What was she hoping for you? And this is now outside of possibilities, outside of the confines of patriarchy. So are you saying that these voices, these expressions, don't find themselves? We don't know who these women were. We don't know who your mother was because of patriarchy.
Yes. We don't see. And I think, you know, women like Umamuini become exceptional because, you know, there's a part when she talks about her upbringing, for example, that she talks about being interested in stick fighting. And I think even with her, it's her father who encourages that, if I'm remembering it correctly.
Yeah.
So I'm saying that women are forced, for lack of a better word, to socialize other women into good girls. The role of girls being good girls and good mothers and good women, it's never a role that men and fathers must grapple with. It's a role that mothers must grapple with. But the people who then can give permission to the defiance, because they are not held to the same standard, is the father. So when there is a father that says, well, I just don't care if my child is a good girl or not, becomes an important person. But that person cannot be without this mother that still says, but don't stray too far, because we still have a patriarchal society to answer to.
You're giving me
you understand what I'm saying?
So I'm holding on to the framing that you've just put through, and it's a whole chapter of a book, a whole movie, a whole societal conversation. Women are forced to socialize girls and to be good girls, and then men, because they don't have the responsibility, they can be the transgressors who open the door for girls to be then whatever they want. But I'm just imagining, particularly in South Africa, where those people are not there and not even interested in transgressing, and just the possibilities that have ended because of lack of responsibility. So I'm just...
you know, which to take it further... is I'm a single mother, and my eldest is a girl.
Woo! Good God.
So I have always felt the pressure that my daughter becomes a proper girl, because it would have been a double failure, wasn't it? To be a mother at 20 years, 11 months, 11 months to be a woman who has never been able to keep a man, because it's still our role to keep a man. Whether this man is worthy to be kept or not, it's neither here nor there. But your role is also to keep a man. And then to have a child that also falls pregnant at 15. Let's assume that is what happened. Because society says you are actually the custodian of patriarchy. You must enforce this thing. I would have been seen as, I mean, I'm still seen as one from the devil, but I would have been seen as the chief devil from the devil. So you can feel the pressure, even as the single parent who's defiant. For an example, some of the debates that happen, people will say, oh, I never bring a man home. You know, I don't want my child to be introduced to all these men. And I'm like, you go see, I prefer having my sex in my house. It's just more convenient. Because in the morning, I can wake up and do the lunch pack. I mean, it's practical. I don't want to be driving from somewhere at 4 a.m. Do you understand what I'm saying? So I'm using that example to be saying, if anything would happen to my daughter, before society comes to me, I would have said, yo, Nko Siyami, hi, but Nami. Nami, I just, you know what I mean? I mean, did I really have to defy society that much? So the space of women being defiant is very small. So in our feminist partnership, even when men are patriarchal, when they are present and they are giving the women the leeway, to just be defiant. You know, I mean, we were talking, I don't remember what event we were talking at. Oh, it was at the intergenerational trauma workshop that Tekano did. And we were talking about early memories. And I'm like, you know, I remember two events. One, I still have the photo. I was wearing a pink dress with a pink jacket and white shoes and white socks that had a frill and a boner. We were at a wedding, and you know how men will sit aside and talk, and women are cooking, and they are sitting in a bedroom, and they are drinking from a mug so that nobody knows that they are drinking. My father had me on his lap, and I was talking. So even in spaces where men were there, my father would put his daughter on his lap and allow his daughter to speak.
And that's my next question.
No, you see, right now, I just speak. Because him.
I was going to say that. So that was going to be literally my very next question. Because in this maze, in the moment as a child and also retrospectively, I was going to ask you, when did you find your voice? When did you say, hi, man, Ndim Lon? Okanye, is it like a continued journey where you're like, oh, Ndim Lon, and then you realize, but there's more to find in terms of your voice?
So I think, so again, man, hey, you know, these systems that we so as I say, I was brought up and I was nurtured into speaking my mind, but throughout that process I was then punished for it,
of course.
So there's always been this dance between, oh, we like you because you speak, and then you say something and they say, we're gonna slap you,
but not like that.
Yeah, you think you are clever, Wena. you think
oh no.
And so you are oscillating between, but I like this thing, this is something I'm good at. But also, it gets me into trouble. You know, it really gets me into trouble. And society does that. Yeah. There is this dance. And then what also happens is then you find places where you do it. And you get into campus and then you do it. And quite honestly, for me, if I am to tell you, is that I think there is the value. And that is why spirituality is so important for me.
Yeah.
I've recognized pivotal moments in my life where I was steered in places that were protective and nurturing. And I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
I went to the University of Zululand, Ongoye.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Ongoye after a massacre, in fact, where the IFP had come into campus. And there was a massacre at Mbangeni at the University of Zululand.
Yeah.
Ongoye. So I got in at that time, and I got in with no life skills, as in filter. Because I come from Joburg and I come from this family where you can talk. I'm 18. I think I know the world. I think I know how society works. I think I know this and I think I know that.
Yeah.
And then what happens is that I got ongoye. And I must say, I first got alopecia, which is a hair condition, misongoye, where I left ongoye. And I think it's important when I speak about spirit, because probably either my voice was going to be stifled or I was going to be killed ongoye with the way that
Holy
I was.
Land. Like, I'm getting killed because I'm like, you are 18 yes. and full of sound in the middle
full
of
sound and also full of foolishness. Basically, you know, and so I left, you know, I left and I didn't leave because something had happened to me because of speaking. I had alopecia and it was very traumatic. And then I went to Wits. And I remember walking into Wits and already feeling in my body that this is a very different environment. This is an environment where it wasn't safe, but this is an environment you can speak. So for an example, when I was at RES and I was a first year, I was a second year in my university, but I was a first year at Wits. There was at RES this whole concept of Pink Panther. You know the Pink Panther?
Yeah.
I don't know you are if you are old enough to know Pink Panther.
I see.
But boys would chill with you and then somebody says, hey man, let me walk you to your door. And then you cram, you open the door, you lock. And once you've changed, this person comes and knocks and then wants to sleep with you. You know, I remember speaking out about it, and Terry Oakley Smith at Barnato Hall, where she was, I don't know if she was the caretaker or the matron or whatever she was, basically then asked me if we want to turn it into a Mail and Guardian article.
Yes.
Now, it had nothing to do with my studies. I was doing a BA in education. But wow, it was the first moment where my speaking out, so to speak, was like, hey, you can do something about this. You can write an article about it. So I wasn't silenced. And that is why I'm speaking about the value of spirit, because I was then removed and then I was put, and also creating an enabling environment. I was put in an environment that was enabling, which was being adverse and then finding that I'm a and these things that I'm talking about, they are serious. Some people are taking them seriously. I don't think I would have been able to do that had I not had alopecia and had I stayed ongoye. Had I not come back, you know. So that's one thing. The other place became Soul City, and hence I stayed for 24 years. I think in a lot of ways, Soul City became the one platform where I even honed it into a profession.
Yeah,
you know, and I found, I mean, I think Soul City was so special in its role and place in South Africa and in the South African society, but also what it enabled and allowed me to do, you know. So I was as challenging within Soul City as I was outside, and my crazy was accommodated.
Right.
My crazy ideas was accommodated. My crazy was accommodated. And for a very long time, it was a very nurturing platform. So I could do it within a safe space. And Soul City, for the most part, became a holder of and a very nurturing space, because in many ways, the kind of organization that it was anchored in research. So the idea that you could learn, it's not only about what you feel and what you want to say, you can learn and you can do research and whatever. It was like, wow. This is something that I can do, you know, and that's why I stayed for as long.
You say nurturing a lot, actually. You say nurturing a lot, and I understand where the value comes from. And just thinking about it, Ngogo, there's something that you inferred as well when you were starting to speak about ongoye. You spoke about protective spaces. What do you mean by protective spaces?
By what spaces?
You said you spoke about there's something about spirit and protective spaces or protected spaces. What do you mean by protective or protected?
I mean, I think nurturing is important because we are forever evolving. And you when you look at the evolution of humans, particularly when you look at children, children are born, or all of us are born with an innate opportunity, let's say to walk.
Right.
Unless if somebody has, you know, was born with a disability or stuff like that. But that when I say it's innate, I mean they're going to stand up and walk.
Mm.
You don't have to buy anything external or whatever. You don't have to install anything in them to walk, you know. A nurturing environment means that the home that the child stays in, you'll remove all the things that will hurt the child as they are exploring and discovering this innate ability.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't stop at babyhood.
Right.
It doesn't stop. We are forever evolving.
Mm.
And so by definition, we need an enabling environment to reach our ever-evolving potential.
Right.
The person that I am today at 50, it's because of all of those nurturing environments I had been in that has really helped me to even shape my own thought, that has allowed me to even try out some things that were very mediocre and that were probably wrong and that failed.
Mm-hmm.
And a harsh environment and a harsh society, this cancel culture that we have, you know, I mean, it's like sex. Young people, and I've said that even with sex, young people are going to experiment about sex.
Mm.
There comes a time when you are a young person, you don't understand these hormones around you. Should all of their sexual experience be coercion?
Mm.
Should they fall pregnant each time they are experimenting? You know, so it's all of those things that I'm talking about. You know, a young woman is going to get drunk somewhere because young people are like that. Brains don't develop until they are young, until humans are until 25 and stuff like that. Should they be getting raped because they did that? So a nurturing environment for me, when I'm older and I'm 70 and I'm 80 and I'm 90 because I intend living for long and I am senile, I don't want to be burned because somebody thinks that I'm a witch.
Mm.
So I'm using that example to be saying at every stage of our lives, we need a nurturing environment.
Okay.
All of us. All of us. Mm-hmm. Even at 90, I would want to be in an environment that understands that, no, she's probably naked and she's digging in the neighbor's can, not because she's bewitching them, but at some point, ingqondo ziyalahleka. Yeah, and
so let's talk about Lebo the lover. We've dug into quite a lot of thematic areas. Lebo the lover. Who is Lebo the lover? Have you met her?
No. Lebo the lover. Lebo the lover is complex. Eh?
Mm.
Lebo the lover is complex because Lebo the lover brings in, you know, a lot of her own vulnerabilities.
Right. Is it unexpected, do you think?
So let me tell you something. Lebo the lover is naive.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have believed all sorts of stories from all sorts of men, some of them that really didn't need to be believed. You just hear some other women who are like saying, "I man," you know, and you're like, "Oh, okay, can a woman be like that? I wasn't aware." You know, the lover has spent most of her life very unsure about whether or not she's worthy. Because I think, you know, in many instances, including being feminist, patriarchy has said, "We're going to show you." So Lebo the lover brings a lot of, you know, just uncertainty about what she's worth.
Right.
Lebo the lover also demands, I think, a nurturing aspect and a vulnerability and an openness that many men don't have and they don't bring.
Right.
So Lebo the lover, even when they meet the men who are the typical patriarch I can provide, they find them very empty, because beyond the fact that I'll buy you an expensive dinner, when you want to know who they are in their spirit, in their soul, you just find an emptiness that is blocked by this facade,
right,
that I've got a fancy kind and that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that those that then don't have the fancy car, because I'm always with the ones that don't have fancy cars and they don't have money, they also just want to break you down.
So
they also, because they also similarly want to be the guy with the fancy car.
Mm-hmm.
When you come and you are the woman with the fancy car and you say to them, but I love you, I vibe with you, we can build something. They are so suspicious of you that they want to break you down.
Right.
And I think what we have taught men to do is that love is about conquering.
Right.
So when they can't conquer you, because most when materially you can't be conquered.
Right.
They want to break you down in other ways. Okay, you may be the CEO, you may have your money, but I'm going to screw four other women just to show you that you are not that special. That's the way that they conquer you. So you are forever in a daze of saying, oh, okay, what am I looking for now? Am I looking for a non-South African guy? Oh, no, they are the same. Am I looking for, you know, one with no money? Oh, no, they are the same. Am I looking for with one for money? Oh, Jesus. And then you remind yourself when you say patriarchy, by the way, same mm-hmm. system, different parts of the system,
mm.
but same system.
Right.
Yeah, but
I hear you. I think the complexity is resonates. I think it's the figuring, it's almost that figuring out, do I just sit here and do I just pick one and just let it all happen? Or do I just decide, I want none of this. I'll get pieces of men, but I'm not taking the whole thing. It would be too exhausting.
I just think the pieces thing in my adulthood has begun to make sense. And I don't know why it makes sense. Because mm-hmm. there's a part of me that says, has patriarchy turned you around? In other words, mm-hmm. have you become patriarchal? Mm-hmm. Have you been the one now that is just wants shallow engagements? Because when you take pieces of men, you can be shallow.
Right.
You know, where you say, I'm not going to take these people seriously. I'm just going to be shallow.
Mm.
But I think that where the pieces for me have been very good is in recognizing that I need not be intense and I need not take everybody seriously.
Right.
Because quite honestly, the majority of them were not supposed to be taken seriously. They really were not. And I think when I took them seriously, they were like, "How? What are you doing now? Taking us seriously, because we are not even taking ourselves seriously, ourselves. Like, there's nothing serious about us."
Okay, so I wanna just go a little bit into, I think, then being older, struggling with that ebb and flow, going back and forth between, I'm worthy, surely there's someone who can make sense of this person who is complex and needs nurturing. And then there's also the aspects of you that are like, younger Lindele makes no sense. Actually, it's patriarchy that's making me choose just one person. Maybe I should just be telling to up and DT. Okay, guys, we are in this, all of us together. All pieces of you make sense. I don't have to choose one. In thinking about that, do you think that I'm thinking about the notion of feminism, particularly in the relationshiping aspect of our lives, for lack of a better word, in our romance aspect of our lives. Do you think that feminism is nurturing in this aspect?
You know, bell hooks makes very interesting points about what she calls almost the failure of feminism, in a sense that what it has done is that it has enabled women to really articulate systemic changes that must happen there, out there.
Yeah.
But it has not all helped us to say, how do we navigate it in our day-to-day lives?
Mm.
And you do find many then women who says, what is out there is not worth, you know, once I've seen, once my lights are on, it's just not worth it,
right.
You know? So, so she was talking about how then women really struggle in their own relationships because the thing that they are preaching out there, they really can come home and say, yeah, now I've got the formula. This is how things are going to be. People are going to say, hey, what are you smoking with her? You know, because patriarchy rewards, you know, and I like the way that she puts it, which I think I'm only in my recent past understanding that patriarchy doesn't come alone. Mm. It's patriarchy, white supremacy, and capitalism. And those are huge systems that have all the resources in the world to put you in your place.
Right.
Okay. So there is no reward for men who give up power and give it up genuinely.
Right.
And they are not going to walk out and really find spaces where they are being applauded. Mm. There is no reward for women who give up patriarchy. There is no reward. I mean, when, for an example, you are the married woman and you are the chief aunt and you are the, you know what I mean? You are the. And nobody was alive. And what do the young people say? Sibawel, SBWL. We all Sibawel something. To be something. You know. And it's tiring to live outside of this. You know, it really, really, really is. You know, I reflect back, and somebody else who also shaped my feminism was my paternal grandmother, who basically lived alone. My paternal grandmother had a boyfriend. My paternal grandmother, you know, the boyfriend was from Botswana and had a family in Botswana. But we knew that he was my father, my grandmother's boyfriend, to a point where his son left Botswana and came and stayed with my grandmother, and we had to call him uncle. You know, and at that time, the whole term of blended families and all of that was not there and stuff like that. And I actually remember, in fact, it's a very funny story, that when I was much, much older, my father and, you must now hear patriarch, my father and his brother decided that they are going to talk to my grandmother because my grandfather wanted my grandmother back. Mm. This was a man who abandoned them when they were babies, and their own lives were shaped by this man who were not there. But they were feeling like, hi, man, our mother is old. How can she has a boyfriend. Let us go and talk to her about taking our father back. And because I was always there, Muslim, I'm in there. And I think this time I had driven my father there. You know, I was an adult. My grandmother just laughed at them. I hadn't driven them. I was at high school. My grandmother died, but I was there. I had gone with them. My grandmother laughed at them to be saying, oh, what's wrong with you? Me, your father, you must be joking. You know? Soon thereafter, she died. But the point I'm making is that even my parents, with everything that they knew, it's like, no, man, can't you be a decent woman just once in a while? You know, and exactly, you know. So it's about patriarchy rewards. And the point is, my grandmother died alone. You know, she died alone. My grandmother, people discovered her body after a while. And that's the choice she had made. So as a feminist and as understanding how my life trajects, I understand that the struggle to even be comfortable about your choices is a permanent one.
Right.
Because we all want belonging. I mean, right now, I was saying to somebody the other day, because, you know, we were just chatting. Just very recently, I was saying to my colleagues, no, next year, I want to call happy to somebody.
Okay.
You know?
Said online.
And then I sat there and I was just like, I've lived alone. I've enjoyed it. But I'm also a relational being, and I want to do, but then you're like, hey, comrade, this could be a patriarchal package. Who are you taking? Like, you know what I, so the minute you even say, hi, man, I want now, you know, to do something, that journey starts again to be saying, okay, are you sure this is what you want? Because you could either be having somebody who is sitting there and cheating on you like you are blue in the face. Is that fine? Or who comes with some things that you don't really like, where you feel like, at my age, is this really what I want? So because these are systemic issues and they are not about the individual you meet, you will forever oscillate.
Yes.
You know, you will forever oscillate between, and that is why you will then see, even with older feminists and stuff like that, they end up, when they are older, having a much smaller tribe of people, or finding the one person where that becomes so private. And I'm sure when they do that, they have like said, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4 are there, but 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 are not.
Mm.
And I'm picking and choosing. So you are forever saying, am I taking this one? No. Am I? No. Okay, let me go for 4 this time. This was my era to just open up tenders for different people. Oh no, maybe not. I'm tired.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's until then men do the internal work that is necessary.
Right.
You know, and so this process of unlearning and whatever is major.
Sure.
It's major. Much. And look, let's say this. You know when the Bible says there's going to be reward in heaven?
Oh, okay. But you better know take it.
No, comrade. Look, when you look back, and you see what other younger women are now able to ask for, you realize that the struggle is not in vain.
This is the truth.
I mean, there are so many things. I mean, my other area of life that I have struggled with has been about my weight, my own sense of beauty and stuff like that. And when you see young people nowadays, you know, regardless of their weight and whatever, wearing whatever,
they want,
and flaunting it, and you're just like, you know what? This is what it was. We are now in my lifetime. I am seeing young girls with this bejeje outside. And I am not marveling at this bejeje only. I'm marveling at the bravery. you know, like, I've done a lot to lose my own weight, but I absolutely love Thick Leonce, you know, because I was like, yeah, man.
Yeah.
Somebody had to go. You know, when you see body positivity and sex positivity, I'm like, yeah, I'm here for this. So I may not be able to be as free and as, you know, like these other young women, because I am born of a different generation. Even when I have really broken a lot of barriers, I do know that there's still some voices at the back of my mind that are playing games. But when I see young women without effort, just owning their sex and whatever, I'm like, yeah, it happened in my lifetime. So maybe it did not happen in my life, but it happened. Yeah, you know, when girls are doing a lot of things, I'm like, yeah, you know.
How are you owning your sex label?
I am owning my sex by making sure that even outside the relationship, I am finding my sex for myself.
Yeah.
And making sure that at least it's not going to be mediocre, because you could be so much looking for the relationship that you want it so much that it comes packaged with mediocre sex. And when you're like, Andizi for mediocrity. I'm also owning my sex by just for myself in my own private space, recognizing that I'm a sexual being.
Yeah.
Which is something that many women are socialized to believe to be, you know, taboo. So when I turned 50, I did a boudoir photo shoot. And I absolutely loved it.
These are the pictures I want, comrade.
And I think for me it was a whole public statement of saying, you know, and it's linked to me having alopecia at 18, where you basically say, you know, I battled with owning this body. And it's almost a, I don't want to say seasonal, I also don't want to say daily, but it's a good one, continuous. Maybe the word is continuous. At different times in my life, I am finding those moments where I'm like, I'm going to challenge myself, you know. So one of the things, for an example, that I have struggled with is my hips and my behind, you know, where I felt, hey man, these things are too big. And, you know, then, you know, social media has its own benefits. And then you just see some people, you know, who are shaped like me, really flaunting their sexiness and stuff, where I'm beginning to wear dresses and I'm like, oh, you know, this body shape, you know, can turn heads and make people crazy, you know, and just sometimes when people flirt with me, I'm like,
you know. This is me. Are you finding it that you're this age, you're the seasonal feeling of, this is me, I'm a sexual belief being, oh, what an incredible body that's carried you for this long. Are you finding that that feeling is more consistent?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was fortunate enough, and I don't think it's about this age.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the work in self-healing, self-care, mm-hmm. unlearning that I have done throughout the 20s and the 30s and the 40s.
Yeah.
Bearing fruit right now.
Oh wow, Lebo.
They are bearing fruit in amazing, amazing ways, you know. And that is why, if I were to encourage younger people who are on a journey of self-discovery, who may not be in the bell curve right now, who may not be, but they do know they want something more, they want something different, they want something extra for themselves, I would encourage them to continue doing that, because there is so much value in doing that. Unfortunately, when you are older, the 20s were rough. They were rough. I just wanted to be a patriarchy princess. I wanted to not talk too much. I wanted to get married. I just wanted somebody to make me a decent woman and marry me and all of that. It's just that my truth spoke much louder. So when I met somebody and I realized that they were not good for me, and I made all these boo-boos and failures and God knows what else. The 30s also, and that is why I like bell hooks talking about white supremacy, capitalistic, patriarchal world, is the fact that when you are trying to make money and buy your first car, buy your first apartment, feed your children, there is very little left for self-care. Okay. The 40s, you've now am a lot more developed in your career, and then you realize the scars that you have, at least for me, from your 20s and your 30s. And all you are learning right now is saying the negative self-talk is not going to do much for you. The wanting to conform is not going to do much for you. The goalposts are forever shifted. But you are still struggling with things. The 50s for me, it's like,
this is it.
You know, children are older. I mean, I was talking to somebody, and also I had my daughter, for an example, when I was young. And my friend, she's closer to 60, and she's only empty nesting now. And the one conversation I was having with her just yesterday, in fact, was like, how does it feel? And she's like, oh my God. You know, who told us that parenting is what a woman must want? I'm owning my life now.
My goodness.
And I'm like, that's what the 50s bring. You own yourself. And if you've done the work, you know, you are now able to invest a little bit in yourself. You are able to even go after the sex you deserve. You know, you are able to do a whole lot. You are able to even have a new persona, you know. And this is the first time, this is the first age where being single has been a blessing.
Yes.
Because I'm not reinventing myself alongside somebody else. You know, I'm really not, because other people who are married have said, oh, once the children leave, you don't know. And some couples find themselves, you know, they rekindle their romance. But I've also had other people who are saying, oh, we are now complete strangers. Because all we did for the past 20 years was to bring up these children. Now we don't have the same interest. In fact, this guy irritates me. We don't have anything in common. For me, I'm like, yo. Bring the groove. Bring the groove. You know what I mean? And then, I mean, right now, if I wanted to date a 30-year-old, I'll date a 30-year-old. I mean, it's like, whatever. You know, right now, it's just like, whatever, you know.
I'm actually so glad that you're doing this cover label, because this evolution that you speak of, I think we say it in bits and pieces, but nobody really expresses just, firstly, how hard it is, and also the liberation involved as you kind of go deeper into time, like as you age older. I think the
that thing of being a good girl who does this by this age and has finished this by this age kind of goes.
And also that's also so capitalistic, you know. Yeah, capitalism must thrive when we feel inadequate. So right now you sit here and you say whatever, you know, and it's, I mean, it's a lot of things. It's also, I'm also, you know, a middle class black woman, so I own my money, okay? But also I've had the big house and whatever, and I realized that capitalism will rob you, will think that your worth will come from the things that you own. So I am also in the process of basically saying what it is that I want. And I was sitting with another 52-year-old last week, who was basically saying, you know what, I'm gonna, they were also empty nesting, their last born was, they had brought them to Cape Town to start school, and we were having the same conversation, who was saying, she's now at varsity, she's now gonna live her life, I'm now gonna sell my big house, because I realized that while it was a status to have a big wife, it does nothing for me. And I've not sold my car. I mean, I've not bought a new car in a lot of years because I've been a single parent. But I've also learned that a big car does nothing for me. So I'm going to look for an apartment. I'm going to be in an apartment. And I'm going to travel and see the world, you know. And I've also had somebody in their 50s who says, you know, I travel and I go on Tinder International, although we now saw the Tinder swindler. But, you know, who basically says, when I get into a country, I switch it on. I switch on my Tinder because, hey, you know, Tinder this country and Tinder that country and Tinder that country, you meet such interesting men. You know what I mean? So all of these things of, hey, who's that man that's going to make me a decent woman? Or who's, they are off. You're like, hey, I did not do these things. Hey, it's expired. You know what I mean? And then you can be crazy that way. But it started with, and that is why nurturing and enabling environments. If women are able to get into jobs and they are able to be paid equal pay, that women's labor is paid for and they are not laboring in what we call, you know, care work and all of that. Yeah. Women are formidable. You know, they will, in fact, I think one day we will even forget that men are there or patriarchy is there. You know, once they pay us what we are worth, because we're like, men where? Oh, you mean these people that we play around with once in a while? Okay, fine. You know, we won't want to relate with men in a patriarchal manner. You know, we won't want to get married and be this decent wife and stuff like that. We may not want to do that. If we own our lives and we, you know, we were paid forever. So I do recognize that.
So this is my last question. What do you want? Like, if somebody said it could be done, what do you want? It doesn't have to be one thing, but what do you want?
I want a life of ease. With all my dreams realizable and my life of a life without fear, a life where I am valued, not because of anything, but because I'm human and I matter.
Yeah.
And a life where love manifests. You know, and when I say love manifests, I mean my friendships are loving and nurturing.
Yeah.
My sex is loving and nurturing. The men in my life are loving and nurturing. The children in my life are loving and nurturing. And I have the extreme freedom to express who I am without fear. That's what I want.
Oh. What perfection. Yeah. Samandi. Samandi. Well, thank you. This is so colorful. Joe, also, you know, sometimes you think you're doing an interview, Kandi, you're also feeling it. So I really appreciate you making this time. I'm sending a calendar request for Wednesday. I just need, I'll have to check with your PA when you're available, because I'd said 11 to Bangani, but he hasn't confirmed, because I'd like for us to look at layout before we do a print.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Okay.